Tonight, our speaker is a man with very interesting story to tell us. But before I have him come up here, I want to introduce one of his babies. And I want this baby to say a few words about his sponsor. And this is Charlie Sanders. Thank you, folks. Just like a dream, 29 years ago, when I saw the daylight of AA. You know, I really come in through the back door. Of course, back in 1940, was only four groups in Cleveland, no downtown office. And my sister told her, why don't you write to the New York office, box PO459. She did. Got an introduction to Clarence, had a nice talk, and he came to the house next evening. I attended my first meeting at the Brooklyn group, and I covered the three classes of AA. I came to see, I came to believe, and thank God that I'm still here today with God's help. But isn't it wonderful to be sober, to look up in the blue sky, and say to yourself, how wonderful it is. And then to get up in the morning after a terrible hangover, you put your hands to your head and you say to yourself, my God, is it morning again? Thanks a million. Come on, Ray.
We'll hear from Hirsch Holland in a few words.
I'm so glad that Charlie was able to say that. And I want to say a few things about we AAs generally. See, we're still blabbermouths and we sound awful and we don't know what we're talking about. It just came to my attention that somebody over around El Mar was saying, well, I wouldn't go to that conference. I don't know how they got that fellow Snyder. He doesn't go to any meetings except those he leads. He won't make a cross-step call. He doesn't do anything. Well, I want to tell you how this fellow has sponsored. When he got a hold of a man in the first few years he was in, he traced some of these fellows for a year. He was known as the best bar stool grabber in Cleveland. He took them off of bars and every place else. And he stayed with him and he got him sober. He'll tell you about it. Not only that, but right now he attends at least two meetings a week besides the meetings he leads. He has organized a retreat in Tampa and has people coming from all over the country, the finest speakers there, almost entirely his own expense. And he's always doing 12-step work even to this day. So I wish you'd tell that fellow up to Almar to keep his big mouth shut.
Thank you, Herschel. Tonight, I mentioned our speaker, and many of us haven't heard him. I've heard him a few times only, and I'm glad to hear him again. Some of us may never hear him again, because he lives in St. Petersburg, Florida. And tomorrow he's going to go back, and we don't know when he's going to come around again. But it's good to have him here. And I want to give you now Clarence Snyder of St. Petersburg, Florida, and he has a very good story to tell us. Clarence?
Well, all these nice things they're saying, I'm looking around to see who this guy is. I certainly appreciate it. I appreciate those words of Herschel, too. You know, I found out one thing in AA, I found out a lot of things, but one thing that's pretty important. Usually the busy guy is always the guy getting the rocks thrown at him. The guy that sits in the back row and never does anything, nobody even knows he's there, so he don't ever get into trouble. Well, anyway, first I want to thank Charlie and the committee for inviting me here. I have never attended an AA function here. I was at this place about 25 years ago, one time with my brother. I don't know what the function was. We were here for a day. Beautiful spot, and I certainly am enjoying myself. I've met a lot of my old friends, and I've made a lot of new ones. This is a nice-looking bunch. I certainly love to see a bunch of AA people dolled up. And I look at a bunch like this, and I just try to picture what would happen if we'd all reversed all at once. We could take and move this place over to Buffalo. But you know, taking a look at a crowd like this, I wish you were all up here so you could just take a look at this guy and see how nice they looked out here. But it reminds me of one of my very favorite rummy stories. I am not much of a one for telling stories, but I do have a couple favorites, and when I see a crowd like this, it puts me in mind of this story of Jerry, the town drunk. This fellow Jerry, no one could remember ever seeing him sober. He'd been drunk around town for years. He was dirty. He was disheveled. He never had a haircut. He needed a shave. His hind end was out of his pants, and his shoes were worn out. And he was just a mess and drunk all the time. This went on for years and years, and eventually the inevitable happened. Old Jerry turned up his toes and died. Well, Jerry's been around so long that he is a community problem by now. So the community had the problem of giving him a burial. So they all got together, and the local barber, he offered his service to shave him and clean him up and cut his hair. The local undertaker offered to lay him out and get a coffin for him. The local haberdasher got him a shirt and necktie, and the local clother furnished a suit. All in all, they got old Jerry all fixed up. But the next thing they had to do was find a preacher to take care of the last rites. So they finally located one that would do it. So this minister got up, and he had everybody in town was at the funeral, and he said, "Well, folks," he says, "we're all gathered here to do the last rites of Jerry. We all knew Jerry. We knew him for what he was. Says, I just don't know just what to say about a fellow like this. I just can't quite find the words," he says, "and I just don't know what I might say about him. But," he says, "I'd like you all to do one thing." He says, "I'd like you all to come up here and take a look at Jerry and see how good he looks since he quit drinking." Well, tonight they told me I shouldn't talk over 3 hours. Because they have some barbershop singers. You know, it gets me in AA today. I don't know what has triggered all this stuff. But there's something new been added to AA over the years, and one of it is clock watching. When I was a drinking alcoholic, we used to turn clocks back in these bar rooms, and no one ever seemed to worry about the clock. But all of a sudden, people get an AA and they run on schedules. They have some place to go and they have to get out of these meetings fast enough. Well, I hope this thing works. It would never have worked for me. I know in the first meetings I ever went to, I didn't have sense enough to go home. And if I had, I'd have missed the best part of my meeting. Because I think I was impressed with more things after meetings than I ever was listening to somebody up at these meetings. Because when I was new in AA, I couldn't even fathom what they were talking about. But some of these fellows took me aside after meetings. This is where I got a lot of the meat that helped me. If I have time tonight, I'm going to tell you something about some of those experiences that I had, if I have the time, which I doubt. One thing that I was asked to do tonight, and I enjoy doing it, is to talk about the history of this fellowship and how this came into being. I've read and I've heard some very weird tales about the origin of AA. And when I hear some of this stuff, I wonder where I was when this was going on. And some of this stuff I read. But I'll tell you what, I'll give you a little rundown on how we were born and how we started here. I guess I better start by saying a word or two about how I came in here. That would probably be a good beginning. Because I came to a fellowship that did not exist. And it eventually developed. And I mean by that is this. When I arrived here, there was no such thing as AA. It was not known as AA. When I hit this fellowship, it was known as the Oxford Movement. And I want to talk about this a little bit. Here's what happened to me. I was a chronic drinker. I was not a periodic. In other words, chronic is a nice word for a guy that's drunk all the time. And that's what I was. And I eventually got to the place where I could no longer perform. I couldn't work if someone had offered me a job. I became completely unemployable. And I'll tell you how unemployable I was. When I was drinking, it was still bootleg days, and it was WPA days. And all of my jug buddies got on WPA, but they wouldn't take me. Now, when anybody can't make WPA, he's a sorry mess. But I couldn't make it, and I've often said that that's a resentment that I had held against Roosevelt for a good many years. If that isn't bad enough, I'll tell you something else. My wife, who was my wife at that time, Dorothy, was very much interested in my going to work. And she tried all kinds of dodges to get me to work, but I had never seemed to connect. And she, of all people, should have been able to, because you know what her job was? She was the head of the men's department in an employment agency. And she couldn't get me a job. So I guess I was strictly unemployable. Well, during that time, I was unemployed for a good long time. And I had a lot of trouble with my family, my in-laws. They kept throwing me out of my own house all the time. And then they let me in, and I got out and in and out like a yo-yo. So what happened finally was I was given my last chance to make it back in the house, in the nest. And this is predicated upon the idea that I should go to work for my brother-in-law, her brother. And he had a big outfit, a truck and trailer deal, and he drove back and forth from Cleveland to New York. He hauled merchandise back and forth. And the plan of the family, they'd had a family council. They were always having these family councils and conferences in the house, and I was never invited to them. I was usually the subject under discussion. And they decided that I should have this job of an assistant. I should be his helper on his truck. Well, I'm the sort of a fellow who's always been against hard work. And this looked like work to me. But I had to say, okay, I'll do it. So this was perhaps a turning point in my life. I started on a trip with my brother-in-law to New York one night, and it was cold, and I was without clothes. My wardrobe had all dissipated. I got on this truck, and I had been drunk for a long time, but I didn't have any drink that day, and I was really sick. And he certainly wouldn't stop and get me a drink either. It was no use asking him. So I was up in the upper part of this tractor. I was supposed to sleep on the top of it, and he was supposed to sleep on the seat. It was one of those sleeper cab deals. So he drove all night long, so next morning we got over here in New York State, and he stopped for breakfast. I remember that. I couldn't handle it. And we went on all that night. The next evening we landed up in Albany, and he was bushed by now. So he wanted to take a rest. And he told me that's what he wanted to do. He's going to lay down for a while. So I said, fine, we're in Albany. It's the capital of New York. I always wanted to see the Capitol buildings here. And away I went. And you know what happened to me. I found an angel in this place that I wound up in, and he was throwing the drinks at me, and I was doing very well with them. And I started back to that truck, and on the way back, they all hit me at once. And I remember very little about this outside of the fact that I stepped on his face climbing into the thing, and he came too, and church was out. So he carried me into New York, and he wound up on the waterfront. He kicked me out of the thing, and he told me that's the end of the line for me and where I should go and so forth and so on. And he wrote his sister, who was my wife at that time, and told her what had transpired. Lying on the waterfront in New York, I don't have a dime. I don't have any clothes, winter setting in, and I don't know but one person in the New York area, and that's another sister of his. The prospects were not too bright. But she lived out in Yonkers, and I had befriended Virginia some years before, and I figured Virginia would look after me and do something for me. And I made it out to Yonkers, and I remember where she lived. She lived way up on top of a hill. But instead of going up on that hill, I went down the hill, and I wound up in the Italian neighborhood down there, and I met some very interesting new friends. And I got into that Dago Red, and you know what happened to me. So by the time I got up to Virginia's, I was a mess. I can only remember one thing about that trip to Virginia's house. I remember rolling around on the floor with her two little kids, her little girls. And I was drunk, I was dirty, and I stunk. And she took a dim view of this, and she put me in the back of her car and drove me into New York, down to the waterfront, and she threw me out where her brother had done so likewise before that. So there I was. I tell this story for a reason, because it has a great bearing on what happened to me. I don't know how long I was in New York. It's a long, long time. But eventually, I got back to Cleveland. I tried to get back home, and the little woman met me at the door, and she had a message for me. It seemed that sometime after I had visited Virginia, her doctor had come over in Yonkers, for one of the kids, I guess, and they got to talking about drinking. And she told this doctor about this drunken brother-in-law of hers, who used to be such a nice guy and who was just the dirtiest, stinking, drunken bum now. And this doctor says, "You know, that's odd. Says, I had a drunken brother-in-law like that once. And he met some kind of a cult, a bunch of strange people. And they spent all their time sobering up, fixing drunk. Says, since his brother-in-law has met this bunch, he hasn't been drinking. It's about 2 years he's sober. And he says, furthermore, there's a doctor, a medical doctor in Akron, Ohio, named Dr. Bob Smith, who belongs to this strange cult, and he spends all his time sober enough drunk. And this doctor told Virginia that if her brother-in-law ever got back to Cleveland, maybe he could be directed down to this Dr. Smith, and maybe Dr. Smith could fix me. So that's what transpired. I don't know anything about it till I got back home, and Dorothy told me about this. And she asked me if I'd like to go and meet this Dr. Smith. Well, I wasn't getting in the house, I knew that. And I had nothing to lose, so I said, sure, I'd like to meet him. So Dorothy put me in the back of her car. These people were always driving me around. They had wheels. And she put me in the back of the car and took me down to the bus depot, and she bought me a one-way ticket to Akron. She put me on that bus with Doc Smith's name and address in my grimy little paw. And that's how I met my sponsor. And eventually, Doc put me in Akron City Hospital. And that's where I sobered up. Now, I'll say something about that hospital trip. I was in there for a week. I weighed 130 pounds when I was in that hospital, which means I wasn't much on the eating at that time. I was a thick duck. When I went in that hospital, I never had a drink from the time I went in there till today. I haven't had one yet. I didn't take any sobering up drinks, and I suffered the agonies of hell in that hospital, I don't mind telling you. But anyway, those men who had preceded me into this fellowship, they came in to visit me. They talked to me. They told me the stories of their life. They were all older men than I was. I just passed my 35th birthday when I came into this fellowship. You don't have to take your shoes off, I'm 66. Those men, I heard this panel today talking about the power of example. This is most impressive to me because these men exercised this power of example on me. They told me their stories. I looked at those fellas, and they were all much older than I was, and they had been through the mill. They were all 100% rummies, believe me, no kidding about them. And they talked to me and told me about it. And they all told me one thing before they left. They told me that they had the answer to my problem, but none of them told me the answer. Doc came in every afternoon and sat there and talked to me. So the last day I was in that hospital, Doc came in, and he said, "Well, young fellow," he says, "what do you think of all this by now?" I said, "Well, Doc," I said, "I think this is great. These men coming in here and seeing me, they don't know me from a load of hay. But they're telling me all about themselves, and I know they're rummies, and I feel something about these fellas. I want to be like them." He says, "Is that all?" I says, "Well, one thing puzzles me." He says, "What's that?" I said, these fellas all tell me that they have the answer, but they won't tell me what it is. What do I have to do? What are you going to do to me now? I was looking for an operation or something. I can tell you what I expected. Because when I went down to Doc's office the first time I went down, he wasn't in the office, and I had to wait for him up there. And I walked back and forth in front of his office up there. It was cold anyway. Didn't want to go out. I was afraid I'd never get back. Every time I walk past his office door, I look at the sign on the door that says, Robert Holbrook Smith, rectal surgeon. I thought at the time this was certainly a new approach to alcoholism. I was ready for anything. I will never forget Doc. When I said to Doc, I said, what are you going to do? What's next? What happens? What's the answer? I can still remember, you folks who knew Doc knew him to be a tall, angular fellow, and I always had the feeling Doc could look right through me, and I think he could. And he had fingers on him about this long, and he used to point them at me, too. And Doc looks at me, he says to me, he says, well, we don't know about you, young fellow. He says, you're pretty young. We haven't had any luck with you, young fellow. They're all screwballs. He says, we don't know if you're ready yet. Can you imagine, ready yet? I didn't have any more home than a rabbit. I weighed 130 pounds. I hadn't worked in 3 years. And I don't know if I'm ready yet. So I had to prove to him I was ready. I guess I had to convince him. So here's what happened to me. People talk about handing the spiritual foundation of AA to people and how cautious you should be about this. I'll tell you how the best sponsor in the world gave it to me. He says, all right, young fellow, I'm going to give you the answer. Get out of that bed. I says, what for? Get out of there. Get on your knees. I says, on my knees for what? He says, get out of there. He says, you're going to pray. I says, who's going to pray? He says, you're going to pray. I says, I don't know anything about praying. He says, I don't suppose you do. But he says, you get down there on your knees. He says, I'll pray, and you can repeat it after me, and that'll be all right for this time. So he gets me right down on my bones on that concrete, and he uttered a prayer, and I followed after him. I don't remember what it was, of course. But it's strange it didn't kill me. And I can remember one thing that happened afterward. He shook hands with me. He said, young fellow, you're going to be all right. I always remember that. So that night he carried me to a meeting. Now this meeting he took me to was not an AA meeting, as we are no AA today. And I didn't know what the meeting was myself for a long time. I was too foggy to realize what was going on at all. But I later found out it was a meeting of the Oxford Movement at T. Henry Williams' house in Akron, Ohio. Most of the people in this meeting were not alcoholics. They were civilians. And the alcoholics were in the minority. We were a minority group. And these rummies, I recognized these alcoholic fellows when I got there who had visited me in the hospital, but the rest of these people, they kind of frightened me, especially since there was a lot of women in there. These women scared me to death. I might say I've gotten over that over the years, happily. But I didn't know what was going on. I really didn't. This Oxford group was a group of people who were trying to live better lives. They called it the life-changing program. And it involved acknowledgement that they needed a better life, they were in need of something better in their life, and it also involved a surrender of their will and their life to the care of God, and it involved living by guidance. This was the format and the plan of the Oxford Movement. So their meetings were this way. They always had a guidance meeting before the meeting. They had a meeting downstairs in T. Henry's recreation room, and they had a quiet time down there, and all the people, the more surrendered people who went down there, had a pad and a pencil, and they'd go into meditation. Whatever come to them in prayer and meditation in the guidance meeting, they'd write on the slip of paper, on their pad. What they're doing, they're trying to choose a leader for the evening. It's surprising how many people got the same name for the leader through guidance. Their meetings were run by guidance, strictly. So whoever was chosen, they'd get tapped to lead the meeting that night. So whoever did this would open the meeting with an audible prayer. Then he would read scripture from the King James Version of the Holy Bible. any comment on it. He could read any kind of scripture that suited him or that he's guided to read. And then he'd comment on it. And then after he got through with his little part in the performance, then the floor was open for witnessing. And people would pop up all over the place and tell all about the sins they had battled with that week, or how they'd overcome, or what victories they had, or how they had lost, or what they witnessed. In this way, they were getting strength. They were sharing. Now, this was the format of the meetings when I came in, and I didn't know anything about what an Oxford group was, and it took me some weeks for it to get through, but eventually I knew it was something. I attended these meetings every Wednesday night. I missed two meetings in 15 months, and I had to go to Akron and back the meetings, and it wasn't easy to get back and forth that way, especially when I was so flat broke. But eventually, after many months, I noticed one thing Doc told me. I'll never forget some of the things he told me. I'm glad I haven't forgotten them. The one thing he told me, which has always stuck with me, and Herschel touched on it tonight, Doc told me that I would have to dedicate my life to serving other people, and that way I'd be serving my God. He said, and the way I can serve people is by helping the alcoholic. He says, any alcoholic is qualified to do this. Other people can't seem to help them, but the alcoholic can. And it was put upon me that I had to spend the rest of my life doing this and liking it. This is what he enjoined me to do. And I have done it. I haven't always been as successful as I'd want to be, and I have not been any perfect example of anything that's great, but I've been through an awful lot of this in going on 32 years, believe me. I've met a lot of people, and I've seen a lot of things happen, and I've had a lot of great experiences. I owe everything to this fellowship and its plan. And its foundation. Now, this was the plan. It took me 7 long months before, an arduous month before I got my first baby. I never figured I'd really be a member of this until I sponsored someone. I figured if I ever got some guy in that hospital in Akron, I brought up somebody in the city hospital, I figured I would have won my feather, then I'd really be a member. Until that time, I just didn't think I belonged too well. I was trying to identify, as you can see. And I was, as Herschel said, I became the first and foremost barstool snatcher in history. I went every place where there were rummies. I'd lay on the floor with them. I'd get under bed with them, get any place with them. And I didn't have any success. The first people I went to were some of those jugheads I used to get drunk with. And I went out and told them that they ought to quit this foolishness. They ought to be like me. And they looked at me and they didn't want to be like me. This guy's nuts. So I had no luck with these. A prophet is always without honor in his own home. I learned that long ago. I finally found a fellow. My first fellow I got was way out in Madison, Ohio, 55 miles from where I lived. And I had to borrow a car to get out there. I'll never forget that experience. I don't have time to tell it tonight, but it was terrific. After a while, things started to happen. After that first fella came in, things started to happen. First thing you know, we had about a dozen of us running back and forth to Akron every night, every Wednesday night, rather. And most of us would go down on weekends and be around those people. Well, things began to happen, and it's an odd thing, how things happen. We have no control over these things. This thing is beyond our control. Anything I've ever done is beyond my control. It doesn't any mind doing. I wasn't this smart. I'm not this smart yet. The things I did, I'm not smart enough to do. I had help, that's all. That's all the only thing I can say. But after we'd been down here going to this meeting for a while, it seemed that these fellas keep coming in, they all seem to be Irishmen. The first guy I got was a Polack. The rest of them all seem to be Irish. There, I think 7 out of the first 12 were Roman Catholics. And they get down in this Oxford group meeting, I tell all these guys that this isn't going to interfere with their religion in any way. So they get down there, these Irishmen, and they see this guy reading out of the King James Version of the Bible. And practically preaching a sermon about it. And then these other people bobbing up witnessing. And they look at this guy, and they look at each other, and then they look at me. And all the way back to Cleveland, they're ecstatic. Trouble. Well, they didn't have, strangely, they didn't have this problem in Akron. They had no Catholics in the fellowship in Akron. It's a fact. They had one guy in Akron who had been a Catholic. He was a fallen away Catholic, which means he was all screwed up anyway. And this guy, he was always drunk. He died that way. I remember poor old Phil Smith. He had a rough time. Some of you folks might have known him. But he never made it. And I can see why. He could never find peace there. Well, anyway, we had this problem. So about this time, the book had come out. The book was written in the fall of 1938. And it came out in the spring of 1939. We had the book. And we had the 12 steps. We didn't have these 12 steps before the book was out. And there was no such name as Alcoholics Anonymous till that book was written. Because the book was named Alcoholics Anonymous, which is chosen out of scores of names that were presented and suggested. So that's where you start talking about how old is AA, how old is the book? The book came out in 1939. Remember that. All right. For having this problem, so the only thing I can do, I'm only in the thing a little over a year myself. I'm only dry, I'm not dry behind ears yet. So I have to go down and talk to Doc about this, my sponsor. So I pointed out our problem to Doc. I said, we have a real problem in Cleveland. We told him about the religious deal here. He says, well, we're not keeping them out. I says, no, the Oxford group isn't keeping them out, but their church keeps them out. Their church will not permit this. There are things that certain churches reserve for their own privilege of doing. They don't go for this reading of the King James Word. They don't go for this open witnessing and this so forth, this confession. He says, well, that's their problem. I says, yeah, I should say it is their problem, but I says, there's something can be done about it. He says, like what? I says, well, we got a 12-step program, and we have the four absolutes of honesty, unselfishness, purity, and love. We don't need anything else. We don't need all this hodgepodge in the Oxford movement. He says, well, that's the way it is. I says, that isn't the way it has to be. So he says, you can't do anything about it. I says, well, but we can. He says, like what? I said, you watch. About that time, we had another Irishman in a hospital. A lot of you folks may have remembered Al Goldrick. He had a big home. He was about to lose it, but he had it. He was in the hospital at the same time Raleigh Hensley was in. I sponsored Al, had him down there. So while he was in there, I talked to Grace about using her house for a meeting place. Great big, nice big house. Fine. She thought that was great. No, you're talking to Al. He didn't even know he was in the hospital. He had nothing to say about it anyway. But Grace thought it was fine. So there's our meeting place, and here's our first split, and here is the first AA riot. So I went down to Akron the following week. We got our gang together. We decided we're going to have our meeting at Goldrick's home on Stillman Road in Cleveland Heights the following Thursday night. So we went down the following Wednesday, and I made the announcement in the Akron-Oxford group that from now on, we will not be down to Akron in a group as such. We are going to start our own group in Cleveland, Ohio, and it's not going to be an Oxford group. It's going to be known as Alcoholics Anonymous. We're taking the name of the book, and that's it. And nobody but alcoholics and their families are welcome. Boy, I didn't have to say that, did I? You didn't think that roof came off the house. You're crazy. This was the first riot we ever had. AA was born in a riot, and AA grows in riots. I get a kick out of some of these birds around AA. They're running around talking about this unity bit. I'd like to know when the hell it ever started. If we ever have unity in AA, we're going to bust up. The only way AA ever grows is through riots. This is our nature. This is us. They talk about AA. You know, this is the trouble with most people. They, on the outside, these civilians, why we can't communicate. They expect alcoholics to be logical, thinking human being.
Jesus.
The logic of thinking human being. I found out in my years around AA that if we do things about diametrically opposite of what we do in good business practice, we make a huge success. But when we start getting sensible and get the idea that we can think, we're in trouble. Whenever I get up on a podium in AA and I see one of those signs, think, up there, I turn it over. I don't want to offend anyone or scare them to death. One thing an alcoholic will never do is think himself out of alcoholism. Alcoholics differ from other people in a lot of respects, but the chief one is this. Alcoholics don't think, they feel. Don't ever forget that. We emote. Why do you think you and I reach one another and communicate? Because of our great capacity for thinking. If any alcoholic walks in this group with a capacity for thinking, he don't belong here. He's nuts to start with, or he wouldn't be here. But we're talking about riots. Why do we start in riots? Why do we wind up this way? Why do we do this? Why do we have such awful, dreadful splits? Let me tell you what happened. We had our first riot when I made that announcement in Akron. It was really rough. It was rough. They said, Clarence, you can't do this. Well, it's done. No, you can't do that. Say, let's sit down and talk this over. There's nothing to talk about. It's all done. So the next Thursday, you know what happened? They all came up and crashed our meeting. And if you don't think that was a riot, you've got another thing coming. And this one guy was going to whip me. There was a couple of these fellas who were alcoholics who would not go along with this. They wanted to stay with the Oxford group people, two of them. And they were, this one guy wanted to lick me. And I don't know, he hollered loud enough you could hear him clear out in the Beulah. But we stood our ground and we didn't give in. That's how we started. We went along for 6 months in Cleveland. And by a strange quirk of experience, I found a guy, the name of Elric Davis, who had been a writer on all the newspapers around Northern Ohio, and he'd been kicked off of all of them for getting drunk. I ran across, a fellow called me, an insurance man in Cleveland, Jerry Halley, down in the Hanna building. I didn't know this Halley, but he just called me, knew about me. And he told me about this man, Elric Davis. He says he's what a fine fellow he is, and what a great possibilities he has, and what a good writer and good newspaper man, but he can't, he's out in a nut house out in Chagrin Falls at the time in a padded cell. His wife had put him out there and threw the key away. He says, Elric is not crazy. He just gets drunk when he's crazy like an Indian. He goes nuts when he drinks, but he drinks too much. He says, there's a good prospect for you, but he's got an awful lot of pride, foolish pride. He says, so we figured out how it'd be the best way to approach Elric Davis. So we got the idea that I should go out there and talk to Elric about the idea that here's a story for him about a bunch of drunks getting rehabilitated. Maybe he could write this story and make himself a buck and that way maybe get back in the newspaper business. So out I go to talk to Elric, and I took a book with me. And Elric went for the idea. He had any way to get out of that pokey, he said. So I talked to his wife, and Jerry did, and she let him out. She got him out. So I took Elric to the meeting up at Dolan Road. I took him to Akron, even, of all things. But I took him up to Stillman Road, and the first thing that happened, somebody recognized him up there and says, what are you doing bringing a newspaper man up here? I said, he's a rummy. He says, he's a newspaper man. I said, I know he's a newspaper man, but he's still a rummy. He said, yeah, he's going to write us up and put our pictures in the paper. And so we have another riot, and they start raising hell with me. I'm in trouble. But I didn't, it didn't bother me. I don't know, like maybe it did, but regardless of which, Elric wrote this series of articles that appeared in the Cleveland Plain Dealer. They ran for a week. When he completed this series of articles, they had an article each day for a week about AA. After that, Harlow Hoyt wrote articles for 3 days, and about that time, Dilworth Lupton, who was a preacher, a Unitarian preacher, he tried to fix me years ago. My wife had got him after me, And he was very unsuccessful. He tried for a whole year to do something with me. He couldn't, of course. And he got to... When I was sober a year, I went back to see Dilworth Lupton. And he didn't know me. And I told him who I was. You know, he dropped his teeth. And he got all excited about his wanting to meet some of these fellas. So I took some of the fellas, Whitwell and Warren Chisholm and Glenn Waddick and a few of them up to his home one night. And he had Dr. Bishop of the Lakeside Hospital Unit. He had the county coroner. He had several judges and people of some esteem in the Cleveland community and some bearing. We were up there till 2:30 in the morning. Those fellas, they just were flabbergasted. They were just so interested in listening to these fellas talk. So we got in with a lot of good people who could help a lot. Dilworth Lupton wrote, he preached a sermon following Elric Davis's articles. About a week later, he came out with a sermon. And his sermon was the story of my life. And he called it Mr. X, an Alcoholics Anonymous. He had that sermon published in a pamphlet. And this was the first AA pamphlet we ever had. It was his sermon. And he had several thousand of them made for it. Elric Davis's articles eventually came into a pamphlet form and became the first pamphlet to come out of New York. Were taken from his writings. So that all came out of Cleveland. You know, you hear an awful lot of stuff about where AA started, and you don't ever hear, you never see anything in print about Cleveland, and actually Cleveland's where AA started. We were born, we were cradled in the Oxford movement in Akron, but the AA got off the ground in Cleveland. Talking to Charlie Sanders a while ago, we had a big blast in Cleveland when we only had four groups there. We had a big party down at the Statler Hotel. Don Schilling was there. He was sitting back there. What was it, 1941, Don? Huh? Well, we had this blast down there, and we had 959 people at a dinner at the Statler Hotel in Cleveland. This was very early. They didn't even have a decent group going to New York yet. Figure that out. So where did AA start? You folks around this area should be very proud of what you've done. We used to have a lot of fun, and I think people still do. But in those days, I think some of the advantages we had were that we were all broke, pretty well broke. When Raleigh Hensley came in, the ball player, he was the only man of affluence we had in our group, I guess. And he had a car. He had a Packard car. I remember this. Packard was quite the thing in those days. A lot of you young people don't even remember a Packard. But he had a Packard, and a group in Akron was having a picnic one time down in the Metropolitan Park in Akron, which runs miles and miles and miles down there. And they invited us to come down to their picnic. So Raleigh wanted to go to this picnic. So he invited any or all of us who could pile into this car of his to get down. So we, the whole gang of us got in his car, and we started for Akron down, so we get down that Metropolitan Park field. Boy, old Raleigh, he's up every group of people. They can take care of 1,000 group there, I guess. It's an awful big place. So every group of people would see, he'd steam up there and grab his brakes and look, it's not our gang. And finally, after doing that a half a dozen times, I said, Raleigh, I said, you're just spinning your wheels. You don't have to do this. I said, take this advice. I said, when you come to a bunch of people somewhere and you see a bunch of cars that look like a junkyard, that'll be our bunch. Sure enough, we get there, there's cars with fenders all off and no running boards and no windows in them. This is the AA. Great. I'll never forget one night. It impressed me so. I went to Akron to King's School one night. I was trying to get back into good graces down there. It took a long time. Some of those people didn't speak to me for several years. I kid you not. I was reading the truth. Some people down in Akron wouldn't speak to me for several years. Because of that split. I lost some friends there. It had to be done. But I went down to King's School one night, and I looked at that yard, that schoolyard, where these cars are parked. Lincolns, Oldsmobiles, new cars. There were very few cars without windows in them. They were something different, you know. People were starting to get up, come up. It's all together different now. It's wonderful. This is a program of growth. I mentioned a while ago, about things I learned down there, not in the meetings themselves, but after the meetings. One of the greatest things that ever happened to me was one night I was down there, old Bill Van Horn. Some of you folks at church certainly knew Bill, and Bill was a big, rough, tough character, believe me. And I was about half scared of this guy, really. And Bill had been in the Akron Nut House out there. His folks had put him out there because he had a pension from the First World War, and every time he got that pension, he tried to whip all the cops in Akron and in Kent. He never succeeded, but he kept trying. And his folks finally put him away. The doc got him out of there and put him in the fellowship, and Bill stayed sober till the day he died. Bill preceded me about 6 months in the fellowship. And he used to take a big liking to me, and every time I get down there, he'd get me in a corner and talk to me like a father. And one time, one night, I shall never forget this. I think this was a turning point, because my mind, my fist blubber, it took so long to get in any kind of sense in it at all. But Bill, one night, he says, "Clarence," he says, "I'm going to give you the answer to this whole ball of wax." He says, "I'm going to give you something here. I want you to read it. I want you to memorize it. And I don't want you ever to forget it, because this is the answer to the whole deal." So Bill takes out this billfold of his, and he had a little table there, a library table. He's taken all this debris out of his billfold. Everything he has in there is all kinds of papers and pictures and cards, everything but money. And he gets all this junk piled up, and he finally found what he's looking for, the slip of paper, and he handed it to me. And I looked at this slip of paper, and it's a Bible verse. I look at that Bible verse, and I look up at that big gorilla, and I thought, Jesus, maybe they did leave him out too soon. But I dare not tell him that. But I did what Bill told me to do. You see, I said, he told me. Nobody suggested anything to me. Whoever got this suggested business in AA? They'd even got the steps screwed up. I went in a group the other night, and I saw it on the wall. The 12 suggested steps. These are not the 12 suggested steps. They don't even read these darn things right. Says these are the 12 steps which are suggested as a means of recovery. These steps are not suggested. These steps are it. See? It's a big difference. They never suggested anything to me. They told me. If they give me a choice, I'd naturally take the wrong one. I've been doing that all my life. I can't give an alcoholic a choice in anything. Tell him. Kick him. Do whatever is necessary. Don't give him a choice. So Bill says, you read this. You memorize it, and don't you ever forget it. And I did just that. And this changed went a long way toward changing my life. That verse was the 2 Corinthians, the 5th chapter and the 17th verse. And it reads, "Therefore, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new." How about that? "Therefore, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new." This is a life-changing program. This is not a drunk cure. Quitting drinking is only the idea of wanting to be sober is only the key that unlocks the door to a new life. I have never found an alcoholic yet who has successfully whipped alcoholism and had a good time doing it. I've seen people who quit drinking without AA, but I have very seldom seen anybody more miserable than those poor cusses. I have to have an easy way to quit drinking. I only got 2 hours to go. I had to have something easy. People say this is a hard program. It is not a hard program, unless we make it hard for ourselves. It's as easy as falling out of bed. It has to be easy. And I'll tell you why it has to be easy. Because I don't think I'm any different than you. You might be smarter than I am, but I doubt it. But I'll
tell you this. When I came to this fellowship, I mentioned before I weighed 130 pounds. I was pretty sick. I was strictly unemployable. I had no home. I didn't have one friend left in the world. Remember this, not one. I remember standing on that waterfront in New York City after Virginia had dumped me back there. And it came to me that I'm standing there in a town of 8 million people. And there isn't one person there or any place else that cares one bit whether I'm alive or dead. No place. I didn't have one friend left. This is an awful thing to come to a person. When it comes to that realization, I was 600 miles away from home, too, and not 5 cents in my pocket. This is rough. Now I compare the situation with the way it is today. I have thousands of friends. I could live on my friends. Do you know I know so many people, closely I know them, all over this country and some out of this country, that if I wanted to, I could come and visit you for a couple of days, I'd come visit you for a couple of days, and you, and I could just have a real ball. I'd eat well, I'd sleep well, I'd be entertained royally, and by the time I come around to see you again, I'd be company again. I can do it. That's my social security. This is the greatest fellowship in the world, and there's nothing like it. And you and I are privileged to belong to it. I was trying to compare it to what it used to be and what it is now, and why we get along the way we do. We absolutely had to get away from Earth people. We just don't communicate, and we couldn't live if we had to stay with them. We couldn't do it. We wouldn't have any AA if we hadn't made that break in Cleveland, Ohio. You wouldn't have any AA. None of you'd be here tonight. Believe that. Unless some other miracle had happened. This is the reason. And why do we get along? Why can't other people do anything for us? They're very learned people. I had $1 million worth of good advice given to me while I was drinking. People told me, I mean real smart people, told me what was going to happen to me if I didn't modify my drinking pattern. I was going to lose my job. I was going to lose my home. I was going to lose my family. I was going to lose my this, that, and the other thing. My self-respect, my sanity, and everything else. And they were right, I did. Everything. I couldn't quit. I couldn't quit till I met a bunch of people who were as I was. I said a while ago that alcoholics don't think. Forget that thinking bit. You get thinking, you're going to get in serious trouble. Any alcoholic who comes in here and tries to think himself out of this. Do you know how long it takes for an alcoholic to start thinking? I mean it. The average alcoholic goes through stages of development. His first 3 months is a very critical time. At 9 months comes another very critical time. See, in 3 months, the alcoholic, everything is so different, and everybody's making a fuss over him, and everybody's been kicking him before. Now they're catching him, and everything's great, you know. Paying attention to him, and the old ego goes up, and, you know, 3 months, he can write a better book than we have. In 9 months' time comes another time. By this time, he gets to be he's an old-timer. He sees a lot of people coming in now. He's showing them how to clean the ashtrays and move the chairs. He's taking charge. Yes, sir, boy. If he lives through that, there's another period comes at the end of a year, usually for a periodic drinker. This year poses a real problem because he's never quite made it. And a year represents something to a rummy. He associates so many things with a year. He's gone and signed pledges. He's sworn off for a year. The judge is threatening for a year. All kinds of things happen about a year. He's never quite made this year. So he makes it an A, and it's very simple. So he says, see, this is easy. Every alcoholic thinks he's different than the rest of them. He's smarter. So he leans back on his oars, falls out of a boat. Starts all over again. If he lives through this first year, Gale, there's another period of this second year, the end of the second year. He sits down one day and he gets looking around him and wondering what the heck's going on. And something comes to him after 2 years. He's been going to his meetings regularly, working with people, conversing with knowledgeable ones and arguing back and forth and having his riots. And after 2 years, it comes to this guy, something gets through here a little bit somewhere, about halfway in, that he doesn't know a bloody thing about this yet. He's got an awful lot to learn. Yeah, I say that's the beginning of wisdom. At the end of 3 years, if he's real faithful, then and only then will can he begin, get that word, he can begin to get logical. Well, don't get any of these rummy thinking. Keep them feeling. You don't believe this? Let me tell you something. I'll prove everything I say. There's nothing I tell you that I can't back up. Let me tell you some personal experience about this feeling business. You know, being around AA as long as I have, people are very good to me. Most of them are. Many of them are too good sometimes, I guess, but I accept it. They invite me all around. I go all over the country to speak at meetings such as this and conventions and retreats and what have you. And sometimes I go places where I've never met a person. I don't know one soul there. Like, for instance, last year, I'm going to Kansas City, and Selma was going along with me. And we've St. Louis, and we're on a plane. She says, oh, by the way, who do you know in Kansas City? I said, I don't know anyone in Kansas City. She says, well, how are they going to know you? I said, I'm going to wear a rose in my hair. She says, oh, you're nuts. I said, yeah, I know. She says, well, no kidding. She says, how are they going to know you? I said, they'll know me. She says, there's thousands of people in that terminal. How are they going to know you? There's planes coming in by the dozens. Don't worry, watch this. So we get off this plane. Sure enough, she's right. There's all kinds of people, thousands of them, milling around like they are in every airport. And we're walking up the ramp there, and first thing you know, we hear somebody holler, there he is! And they all come paddling over, you know. I don't know one damn soul in this bunch, but they all know me. Why is it? Why do they know me out of a thousand other people? I went up one time to Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan. Did you ever hear of Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan? Now, this is the other end of the world. These astronauts almost made this. You take planes and planes and planes from Florida up there. This is really a trip, believe me. So, the last plane you take is out of Minneapolis, and it's going to Regina. After Regina, you mush. And it's always on Friday night when you go on these deals, and the planes are always crowded. And the airports are crowded. So I get into Regina, and all the people are waiting for the planes to come in to see what shape the boys are coming home in, you know. And all the peddlers are coming home, and all the travelers, all the guys are getting off the plane. There's 150 people on the plane, guys, mostly men. Now, I know I don't know any Indians up in Saskatchewan. So the same thing happens. I'm walking off of there, and there he is. They know me. Why do they know me? Why do you walk down the street, as I have done many times, and a panhandler will pass up 15 guys, and he'll walk right up and put the arm on me? Why does he do this and pass those other 14 people? I'm a brother under the skin. He feels something about me, and I feel something about him. We have a communication of feeling, emotion. Alcoholics live by emotion. They don't live by any sense at all. And this is one big mistake that people always make about alcoholics. They expect them to be logical, thinking human beings. And the alcoholic is not. He is a creature all his own. He's a breed of cats all his own. The alcoholic has definite characteristics, and you can tell an alcoholic by characteristics. I don't say that some of the civilians don't have some of these characteristics, but they don't have them all. Everybody can't be an alcoholic, remember that. This is a privilege reserved for a chosen few. And if you got it, you got it. If you don't have it, you'll never get it. One thing I dislike, there's a number of things. You know, I'm an amateur AA. I have never gone professional. And I maintain my amateur standing, and as such, I maintain my right to criticize. And I sure can do it. But I say one thing. I keep the general public the hell out of my AA business. I have tried to educate the public, and it's fruitless. I have enough jobs trying to get points across to a rummy. I'd waste my breath and my energy and get heart trouble and ulcers trying to explain this to a civilian who will never understand it anyway. Forget it. I don't care about it. I don't want outsiders bothering my AA. Keep them out. The only AAs that belong in the only non-AAs that belong in an AA meeting are the immediate family or immediate interested person or maybe someone by invitation of the group. But this thing, as they're doing in so many areas, just throwing the doors open and running an ad in the paper to come to the meeting and inviting everyone, this is a lot of crap. They talk about anonymity. They don't know what anonymity is. They run around letting everybody in the creation come into their meeting halls and they run around calling themselves George and Mary and Steve. George and Mary and Steve, who? You are my friends. I want to know who you are. I may need you someday. And I don't know how to call Mary, Joe, and Steve. If you keep all those civilians out of your group, you don't have to hide in a secret society. Believe me, I holler for some of these things that are fundamental in AA as far as I'm concerned. I've seen too many things happen to people. We'll never hurt each other. But we'll hurt each other trying to kowtow to a lot of people who don't belong here anyway. So much for that. Well, anyway, I think that I have probably marked the difference between the Oxford movement and AA, and I've tried to show how we were born and why we are here and what we're trying to do. You and I belong to the greatest society in the world. And you and I are chosen for this. This thing of alcoholism is as old as time itself. It's been here. We read about alcoholics and alcoholism in ancient history. We read about it in Greek mythology. We read about it in the Bible. And all the things were tried unsuccessfully. Only in the last few years have a few thousand of us been privileged to get the secret of success in this. You and I in AA. We should be very careful what we do with it. And we should do everything in the world to preserve it. And we should exercise every bit of what we have in it to carry that message properly. How fortunate we are when we think of how long this has been going on. And just you and I, ask yourself sometime, why were you chosen? And not all these other millions of people who staggered across the face of this earth and died, alcoholics, and died in disgrace and carried their families and friends down with them in many cases. Ask yourself this. It's a great responsibility. Alcoholism is mentioned in the Bible. There's some terrific rummy stories in the Bible. Would you like to hear a couple before I... Take the story of the Jericho Road, the Good Samaritan. Here is a rummy story, and I'll prove it to you. Everybody in this story is a rummy. Here's this fellow. He's lying out there in the middle of the road, stripped. He's naked. They took his clothes, they beat the devil out of him, beat him up, robbed him, threw him out in the middle of the road. What happened to him? He got drunk and he got rolled. Very simple. How do I know this? Well, first the priest comes along, and he sees this guy laying out there. He knows what happened to him. Just a dirty old drunk, good enough for him. He gets drunk, he should get something happen to him. The hell with him. He passes on the other side. Right? Isn't that what happens? Along comes a Levite. And he sees this guy laying out there. He can smell it. He knows what it is. So he passes by on the other side. He's not going to get concerned with this guy. None of his concern. So he passes by on the other side. Along comes this Samaritan fellow. Now, the Samaritans were not the elite of society in those days, not by a long shot. This fellow's a traveling salesman. I'll prove that to you, too. He sees this bird, and he's also a member of AA. He sees this bird laying out there, and what does he do? He gets down off of his form of travel, probably a mule. And he administered to this fellow, cleaned him up. And he put him up on his mule and he took him to an inn. It says in the good book, he took him to an inn, see? So here's how I know they're all running. He says to this innkeeper, he says, here, take care of this fellow. And here's some money. See, he gave the money to the innkeeper, not the running. Take care of this fella. Here's I know he's a traveling salesman. He says, then if there's any more due, I'll pay you next time I come through. See, he's making that territory. Very simple. It's an AA call. He took care of him. Saw that he was looked after, and he was going to pursue it. He wasn't going to quit there either. That is an AA. What is it? All right, how about these other fellas? These two boys. Prodigal son. Boy, here's a rummy story. Think of these two fellas. These two brothers. In Jewish custom, the two sons are supposed to inherit whatever the old man has when he dies. The old man has a big ranch, a big farm there. And these two kids are out there working on this farm. But this one kid, you know what he is? He can't wait for his. He can't wait till the old man dies. He wants his right now. So he keeps bugging the old man for his share of the loot. And he bothers the old man and bothers him for this share of his estate. So the old man can't take it anymore. He just bugs him so much. He says, here, take your part and be gone with it. So he gives the kid his share of the estate. And what does it say in the good book? It says he went into a far country and he squandered his substance in riotous living. You ever hear of anything like that? This kid got out and he blew the whole bundle. And what happened? It says in that story, there's a famine hit the land. And he was without everything. And the only job he could get, now keep in mind, this kid's a Jew. The only job he could get was on a hog farm. And he's feeding hogs and taking care of hogs. This is a great job for a Jew boy. And what's he eating? He isn't eating what the hogs eat. He's eating what they have left over. Because he's eating of the husks of the hogs. This boy really came to his bottom, didn't he? He hit the bottom? I would say so. So then what happened? The kid got... He's so frustrated. He says, my father has much. And his servants have much, and I am here, I starve. Here's what's important, he says. I will arise. Remember this. This is exactly what we have to say. I will arise and go to my father. This is what we have to say. That's what Doc made me do on my knees. See? I will arise and go to my father. I will tell him I'm not worthy. See? So the kid moved. He got off his duff and went. This is what we have to do. So he went. And what happened? Did the old man chew him out when he saw him coming? No. It says in a good book, he says, the father saw him coming afar off. And he ran to him. And he fell on his neck and kissed him. He says, my son who is dead is alive. He says, let us make merry. He put a ring on his finger, shoes on his feet, a robe on him. Let us make merry. My son who is dead is alive. Such great happiness. This is what the good Lord does when he sees us come back. See, same thing. Remember this. This great thing of forgiveness. This thing of repentance. He says, he'll arise and go to his father and tell him he's not worthy, which he did. And what did the father do? It just tells us what he did. So he takes him up there and they're having a big party. They're having music. They're having a blast up at the house. So what happens? Here's the kid, the other boy, the civilian. He's out there in the field working like any good civilian will do. They have to work. Servant comes out there. He says, hey, boy, he says, what's going on up at the house? He says, haven't you heard? He says, heard why? He says, your brother came back. Ooh, that's no good. You know, right away. So he stomps up to the house and says, Pop, what's with this guy going? What, he sent away and he blew everything he had and you give him a party? He says, what's with this? He says, you never gave me a party and I've been here all the time. See? How about that? Doesn't that sound like one?
Exactly. So the old man had to get him straightened out on that, on why. He was dead and he's alive. This great thing, the resurrection, the story of Christianity. This is a story. This is a story of our life here. The story of AA. We're all resurrected. We have new life. We're all reborn, rebirth, new people. Old things have passed away. All things have become new. This is our story. I hope I said something that might be of good to someone. I would go into the program tonight, but I think my 3 hours is up. It's been a great pleasure being here and talking with you. And we can hear singing any time if you can't hear this. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this recording. Please check out our website at sobrietytalks.com. You can also contact us by sending an email to sobrietytalks@aol.com. Thank you.